Good day and welcome to the Oil Ground Up podcast with me, Tony Greer, presented by the Clear Commodity Network. Today we're going to welcome everyone's favorite green chicken, Mr. Doomberg. From the chicken coop, Doomberg and I will tackle main events of the oil trade, including a head fake in the SPR news and how some errors on the renewable energy front may provide another boost for the robust fossil fuel market. This episode and all the others within Clear Commodity Network can be found at clearcommodity.net. Let's jump into my conversation with the chicken. So let's get right into the oil market, shall we, Mr. Doomberg?
Tony, how you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Sorry to surprise you like that, but I wanted to make sure that everybody, before I went into the intro about what's going on in the oil market, I wanted to make sure that everybody knew I had my favorite chicken on the show today, and I'm excited to talk energy with you.
Yeah, same here, Tony. Congratulations to you and Trevor on the show. I'm big fans, as you know, and I consume all of the content that you put out, and of course, I'm a paying subscriber to the Morning Navigator and a member of your Slack channel, which is the first thing I check when I wake up in the morning. So anytime you reach out, ask me to have a conversation, it's a real pleasure.
You're the absolute best, and that feeling is mutual. We consume all the Doomberg content that comes out, and we love it. That's why I've got you here today. I want to hear about what's on your mind in the energy markets. I am pretty oil-focused on this podcast, so I'd love to start there.
Sure.
You know, we just peaked our head above $80 in WTI crude oil. The setup is kind of as follows. What just happened was we had the calendar tighten considerably, really led by a move in gasoline, where basically the front month gasoline spread went from 16 cents to 30 cents all in the month of July. That widened out the crack spread from $30 to $40. WTI tightened up considerably in the same time period. So we've got a much tighter oil market than we had the last time we poked our nose into the 80s. I am just wondering how you're looking at oil today, Doom, and then we'll go over other sectors of the energy complex.
Yeah, great question. You caught me at a good time, as the song would go. We did our we did our monthly Doom Zoom for our Pro Tier members this morning. It was a fun presentation, lasted about an hour, and yeah. It was titled "Doom Scrolling." You know, searching the globe for things to worry about, and one of the sections of that presentation was titled Oil Market Mayhem. And we led that section with an observation about the Strategic Petroleum Reserve that I'm not sure all that many people have internalized, which is we're done emptying the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. You know, this was flagged to me by our mutual friend, Rory Johnston, over at Commodity Context, another great Substack. Basically, in January, Congress effectively canceled 140 of the 147 million of mandated barrels of oil to be sold out of the SPR over the next 4 or 5 years by retroactively claiming that the releases in 2022 were those mandated sales. And what that means is we just worked through the last of the I think it's 26 million barrels that were to be released in 2023. After that, the market's on its own. And there is no million barrels a day, you know, absent a new initiative, which would be politically pretty untenable in our view, by the Biden administration to further empty the SPR, you know, that cushion that really we think, and I think you probably would agree, was a critical input into the collapse of oil prices from that 125 level down to the low 70s, that headwind has now been removed. And that is the key. I think everything that you quoted, all of those numbers would be consistent with the market internalizing that buffer of supply no longer finding its way into the market. And then you combine that with the Baker Hughes rig count turning over quite a pronounced fashion. One begins to wonder whether the source of 90% of the world's growth in oil production, i.e. the Permian Basin, is set to turn over. Numbers don't yet show it in the Permian, but overall, the U.S. is kind of flatlining here. Now, there's a counter argument that offshore is going to make up the difference and the baton will be handed from shale to offshore, and we'll believe it when we see it. But those two data points, you know, lend to a bullish outlook for us as it pertains to oil.
Yeah, that's why it's really interesting. You know, we have tried not to, I've tried not to get my clients dragged into the energy market until it feels like something is going on. There's a catalyst or the time is right. And that certainly feels like what's going on right now. I know you remember, Doom, the last time OPEC cut production, it was that April 1st secret production cut that they didn't give any indication on. And they ouched the shorts, you know, right up into the low 80s, maybe high 70s there. And the market turned back around. We probably worked through some more SPR sales. You know, a little bit of a probably slowdown in the economic activity read. And now on this side of that conversation, like you said, we've got no more SPR for sale. We've got now the U.S. economy as of today's GDP data kind of putting off the idea of a recession, and energy markets are perking up. So if you ask me, the vulnerability with no SPR sales and OPEC potentially, you know, either keeping these cuts on the tape or cutting again, the upside is explosive or potentially explosive now. Would you agree here? Like, do you think we can sail away, or are we just going to move into a 75, 85 range?
Well, we're coming into a pretty important resistance point here. You know, we put a chart in this presentation called Saudi Seriousness, where we showed, we used Brent here because that's the benchmark. I think the Saudis probably follow a little more closely than WTI. So, you know, add $2 or $3 to WTI and you get Brent. That chart since last November is range bound between, you know, 72.5 and 87.5. And anytime it gets below that 75 level, OPEC takes an action. And then anytime it gets, you know, above that 85 level, the market seems to turn over. So to us, the sort of critical resistance price to plow through would be that mid 80s and into the 90s. And then you would see, just looking at the chart, I mean, this is obviously your domain, but you know, there's this view in the market, by the way, which is an interesting one. I think Dr. Anas was the first who pointed out to me that perhaps the baton on SPR would be handed from the U.S. to China. China has a very large strategic petroleum reserve as well, and it's a net energy importer, particularly oil. And it has something like 460 million barrels of capacity in its SPR. So in theory, they could be perhaps the source of some new resistance. But in this same presentation, we talked about Kyle Bass's presentation at the Hudson Institute on whether or not Xi Jinping is preparing for war, you know, over the Taiwan issue. And so if based on the data that Kyle Bass showed, if China is actually preparing for war, either offensively or defensively, then you wouldn't imagine that they'd actually care about the price of oil. They'd care more about the supply. And so we shall see. I think we're at a, you know, in this sort of $85 Brent range that we are today, it's decision time for the markets, in our view.
Very much so, Doom. And I love the way you phrase it that way. You know, when I look at the chart, the whole story comes to life to me. You know, you can see that gap higher right to that peak that you're talking about in April, where Brent, we'll stick with, traded up to about $87 and change. We're now approaching $85 and change. So yeah, that is the top of the range. We get through there, and technically speaking, in my book, there's really no resistance until we get to about $98.
That's what it looks like to me, yeah.
Yeah, and if you look in the rearview mirror, what's even more excited to me is that, you know, in Brent, there's a crystal clear, I don't know, like a 5X bottom, like you don't get to see very often in charts, which is just a convenient place to put your stop loss. And we've got that, you know, unfortunate, you know, we've got a big loss in the rearview mirror with Pierre Andoran declaring another major loss on the lows. So it's like we've shaken out all the length. Open interest is really depressed. And I just feel like the, you know, the upside, if the traders want to come after this and funds want to come after oil on the upside, this is where all the action is, in my opinion.
The only challenge is, of course, you're trading against the Fed effectively, because the Biden administration would like oil prices to be contained.
And yeah, you know, go ahead, Doom.
No, not to be conspiratorial, but like it's just reality of the market. Like that when the full weight of the U.S. government would prefer a certain price, trading against that price can be pretty stupid.
Yeah, for sure. And it's kind of like, to me, it feels like the government is, the Federal Reserve is trading against the sort of politically based inflation, right? And I look at it that way because, you know, it's the executive orders of the Biden administration and their posture towards drilling that has sent prices here, and they've kind of thrown the job of dealing with it into the Federal Reserve's hands. And so, yeah, the Federal Reserve is definitely making their clear case that they want to be very much against inflation rising again. They're trying to put it back in the 2% bottle. And, you know, everybody that's out there in the energy world is sitting here saying, yeah, you're not going to squeeze inflation back into the 2% bottle while you're also canceling drilling leases and, you know, everybody's pulling their rigs out of the ground. So that's why I feel like, you know, this is, we've got politically structural energy inflation, and the job of dealing with that is thrown in the Fed's lap. And now they have to fight what is the natural move in oil just wanting to go higher now.
Well, you know, it's a fascinating point that I, because in this, again, not that just, I just, it's fresh off the presses. So we had a slide called Our Rate Creases Inflationary, which is an idea we borrowed from Luke Roman with full credit. You know, the Fed has never hiked interest rates so aggressively with the debt on the books being this high. And one interpretation of, you know, interest rate payouts by the government is, in fact, these are fiscal stimulus for the rich. Now, the velocity of that money might be lower, but we're about to cross $1 trillion in interest payments. Those interest payments are going to people, ultimately, who spend money. And then on top of that, interest rate hikes increase the cost of capital for energy companies. And so there's a school of thought that Jerome Powell is playing from an old playbook. I believe Mike Green is a big subscriber to this school of thought. Mike Green from Simplified Capital, who's has forgotten more than we'll ever know about the market. And so, it's a fascinating, you know, at five, well, just run the math here, Tony. Like at $32 trillion in debt, 5.5% rates. You know, obviously, once we churn through the duration of the portfolio we have today, if you are just do 5.5% times $32 trillion, you're looking at $1.8 trillion a year in interest payments alone. How is that not hyperinflationary? And so, yeah. You know, there's the official CPI and what people talk about on Twitter, and then there's your lived reality. I bought a Jimmy John's beef sandwich and a bag of chips that cost me $12 the other day. Like, I don't know about you, but a slice of bread with some lettuce and some beef and some tomatoes and a bag of barbecue chips didn't used to cost $12.
Yeah.
That's not my lived reality, brother. I mean, so. You
know. No, absolutely, man. I remember when my budget was $5 for lunch on Wall Street, and that was no problem. I could eat all I want. I had sodas left over and usually a snack left to take home for the $5. So yeah, the world has changed dramatically at that end. I like that idea that the interest payments could be inflationary. I like it because I feel like I am seeing the market pick up an inflationary impulse that I am not seeing in the market, right? Base metal prices are going nowhere. Grain prices have recently perked up, but generally speaking, they're not, you know, forcing the highs where people are uncomfortable. You know, gas prices settled back into the 350 range, and the market-based inflation expectations have kind of perked up. Rates are, you know, at the high end of the range, pushing the high end of the range. And I'm sitting here saying, what is the market seeing that's so inflationary that's kind of not in front of my eyes? And so maybe it's that type of calculation, like, well, Luke Roman.
Let me ask you this question, Tony. Like, if you just saw the government expenditures without the labels, you would say that the deficits we're running are very inflationary.
Yeah,
and
that's fair.
Just because of, like, the wedge of that deficit happens to be interest payments to wealthy, you know, investors, the investor class. It, again, it has less velocity than, you know, the food stamps to people who desperately will turn around and spend it. Like, we all agree, but it's still, in a way, we've never, again, the playbook, the axiom of the playbook is hiking rates slows the economy. That doesn't seem to be playing out. Why is that?
Exactly.
Yeah. So the one reason, which again, to be fair, if you would have told me a year ago that we'd be at 5.5% rates, I think I sent you a meme in your wonderful Slack about, like, somebody who had a coma and woke up and found out that we were at 5.5% rates and a few other data points. It's like, great, I can't wait to see how well my puts are doing. And
yeah, exactly.
And then insert the meme of Jerome Powell with the middle finger out, you know, F your puts. Like,
That's so great, Doom. I love that meme because that meme is, you know, everything that's wrong with the way people look at markets. You know, you can use that as a sort of introductory meme to saying, look, guys, you know, the market isn't necessarily going to do what you might expect it to on a read through on the economy or on a read through on interest rates, right? The market is the market and the market responds to the total collection of stimuli and not just where interest rates are, not just what the economy is doing, et cetera. So, I mean, the argument for the stock market for me, for the bull market, even though we're a little bit off the topic here, this is a great market conversation. You know, we're wearing through higher interest rates because the market can bear it. And the market can bear it because the 2.4% GDP quarter that we just had, right? The reason that the market can bear higher interest rates is because the economy is strengthening behind it. And that's why the S&P is still 4,600 bid, or call it give or take. We traded up to 4,630, a new high for the move this morning, and back off to 4,600. So everybody likes to get a little bit doom and gloomy here about stocks because rates are going up. And I don't subscribe to that type of thinking at all. So that's why I love that meme. So we can close that conversation up and keep moving here. I want to ask you, Doom, I know that you're a great student of the broader energy market. And while I feel like we kicked the tires really, really thoroughly in oil, is there anything else across the energy spectrum that is very, very topical for you? I know you've been writing about a number of different things, be it nuclear or about natural gas you've written about extensively. What's kind of topical on your minds lately, if you could?
Yeah, two topics that we covered today. One is what we think will be ultimately the beginning of the unraveling of the wind energy sector. There's huge challenges in that sector. You know, the sector has made a critical error, two critical errors, really, in their zeal for quote-unquote efficiency. They have tried to go to longer and longer blade length, which in theory does allow you to generate more electricity from each installation, but in reality poses a balance of systems set of stresses that I think have been wholly underestimated. You know, the stems, the gearboxes, the failure rates in the field are far exceeding what people have been modeling. This whole sector is ripe for, I think, a catastrophic renewal or reintroduction to the laws of physics. And so nobody's making money in the sector. The whole fraud of levelized cost of electricity is about to be exposed. Many developers have signed fixed electricity rate contracts in order to gain the bid, and they just can't make any money. And so they're paying the contract fees and walking away. A major player just did that in the UK. We would be deeply bearish the wind sector in general. Even though we're about to turn a fire hose of cash onto it from the Inflation Reduction Act, this is the ultimate throwing good money after bad in our view. And then the other thing we talked about today was peak complacency in Europe. You know, the Dutch TTF contract is deader than dead. Everybody believes that last winter was a validation of sound strategy and not just a lucky roll of the dice. And you know, we pointed out in the piece, and I shared with you the graph. You know, in March of 2023, a three-year La Nina event came to an end, and now we're into an El Nino. And if you just look back historically, during La Ninas, Western Europe has warmer than average winters, and during El Ninos, they have colder than average winters. And last year was the winter that never came in Western Europe, which is the reason why they were bailed out, and thankfully so. But with LNG rates at $10 a million BTU, and everybody thinking that the problem is solved, you know, when you have peak complacency, you probably want to be on the other side of that trade, as you know. And so just put it out there for our pro subscribers to have a look at and to ponder and put into their models. But we shall see. You know, in every report that I see, because, you know, it's just been hyperbolic, the temperatures, and now they're changing the way they measure it, and all the maps are redder, and global warming this and heat that. It's an El Nino effect in our view. And every single report that exaggerates the current heat wave to us is an input into how cold it's going to be in Western Europe this winter, because nobody has this on their radar. And so this was again another thing that we showed our pro subscribers this morning.
That is such an excellent point, Doom. If you want to talk about it from the perspective of investing, and you know, on both sides of the market, it's always the case that when you know securities get left for dead, that they finally wake up in a huge way. And I mean, the Dutch TTF natural gas just fits that storyline so well, where, like you said, you know, they got huge bailouts last winter by the weather. They were writing subsidy checks like they were going out of style, and they finally got the problem under control. and they're still susceptible, right? They're still susceptible no matter what, because they're still not creating the same amount of gas that they've been. They don't have the mountains. They don't have, they won't have enough in storage if they have an exceedingly cold winter, that much we know. So the problem hasn't gone away. And what's best about it is that, you know, it's like buying the VIX at 8. You know, it's like when the VIX is just depressed, as you know, to a single digit number. It's the, one of those times that the S&P is having no range and it's kind of creeping along at the highs. And the next thing you know, VIX goes from 8 to 20 and everybody's like, holy smokes, what just happened there? So I could definitely see, and I will be trying to look for plays along those lines about how that could play out as we head into this winter. And when it will play out is probably, you know, in the fall months, when there's a little bit more uncertainty and you just get a little bit of a shakeup towards colder weather or something like that.
Yeah, we'll see. So that's really... We'll see. I'll do my best Jared Dillon impersonation. The number of people tagging me and making fun of me for the natural gas contract price in Europe, even though the very first article we wrote predicting the crisis was in October of 2021, long before the price of natural gas in Europe quadrupled and 5X and Russia moved on Ukraine. The piece we wrote in October of 2021 was called Putin's Fools Rush In. And that piece stands the test of time quite well in our view. But there's no question that, you know, from the, you would call it an Icarus print of $100 per million BTU that happened in the fall of last year, the price is off 90%. Of course it is. And so, right, the whims of Gaia smiled on Europe. And we've been writing and warning, do not confuse good fortune with sound strategy. But, you know, Germany shut down its last three nuclear power plants. And everybody is like, ha, 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 Chicken Little, literally in this case, which is fine. You know, like we were talking before we pressed record, like if you make a lot of calls, some of them probably aren't going to materialize. But we would say, you know, as schools of Jared Dillon, that there is a peak complacency in Europe today vis-a-vis the upcoming winter.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, if his big warning signal is there's too many assholes in the trade, I mean, this is certainly the exact opposite, where everybody's given up and they're throwing rotten eggs at you for even saying that there could be another rally in Dutch TTF this year. So that's a great point, and I love it because everybody is sleeping on that idea. It's like something that happened once in the past, and it's all been done and dusted, and they don't have to worry about it again. You and I know better that it is more likely to become a risk than not, at the very least. So we'll definitely keep our eye on that story. One last question, Doom. Is there anything on the nuclear front that's exciting to you? To me, I look at it as the uranium market, the uranium ETF has been doing, you know, fairly well this year. It's been rallying at least a little bit as the energy market has been rallying. It's actually only up 10% on the year as a sector, but not too bad. And it feels like the case is getting better and better despite what's gone on in Germany with them shutting down nukes. What's your just last, you know, 90-second read on the nuclear story?
Sure. Outside of Germany, we see a renaissance of historic proportions unfolding. We've written pieces about Ontario. We've written, you know, made reference to the situation in Japan. Even Belgium has done an about face. The U.S. has done an about face in its own way. Everywhere we look, we see a reconciliation with physics. You know, the path function matters, but ultimately there is no path to, you know, reasonable decarbonization that doesn't run squarely through nuclear power. I think the last of the crusty old Malthusians are exiting the stage. Some of the younger generations of environmentalists, having studied the problem and lived the various proposed solutions, are settling on what physics dictates as the only answer, which is, you know, nuclear power. And we are seeing this, you know, we wrote a piece called Cheat Codes, which made the case that Ontario is a good decade ahead of the U.S. in its energy policy journey. And why can't we just skip the in-between? You know, they had this amazing Green Energy Act of 2009 that torched $60 billion of taxpayer money. And on a per capita basis, that's the equivalent of the U.S. torching $1 trillion. And then they went back to nuclear, and they're like, you know, new large reactor builds, new small modular reactor clusters being installed, refurbishments of existing facilities to allow them to run for decades to come. Doug Ford and the Progressive Conservatives, which sounds like an oxymoron here in the U.S., but that's sort of the Canadian label for what we would consider relatively center. Doug Ford and his team have done an amazing job of putting the chess pieces on the board to secure for future generations of Ontarians a carbon-free, reliable, electricity grid that can withstand the growth that's coming their way because it is such an amazing little province. And they are in many ways the exception that proves the rule. Ontario has embraced nuclear full blown. They have CANDU reactor technology. They have an amazing workforce. These are well-paying labor, union jobs. The left should love the nuclear versus solar and wind. And so ultimately, we do believe that after we've wasted our time and tons of money trying all the wrong answers, we will have to settle on the right one, and the right one is nuclear power.
That is so well stated that I can't touch it, Doom. That is perfect. We'll keep an eye on the story in Ontario. I think that we can wrap up here. I kind of like the way that we kicked all the tires in crude oil. You made a great point that the SPR sale is likely over. We hashed out natural gas and try to keep that on people's radar, especially the Dutch TTF situation, which could bubble up against this winter. The nuclear story is well intact, man. I mean, we've got the energy market covered here, I think, don't you?
Absolutely. Last point I would make is the best way to find Doomberg's work is to join TG Macro Slack. Get to know Doomberg intimately in that Slack room, and then maybe after that, if you're satisfied, you can come on over to doomberg.substack.com and subscribe to us directly. But go through Tony Greer first, and then you might end up at Doomberg, and then you'll get the 1-2 punch.
That is very kind of you to say, Doom, because we do have more fun than a frog and a glass of milk in my Slack channel every single day, and that's where we have several over 100 ninjas discussing markets on a regular basis, and we really get down and dirty in there. So it's a really good place to be, a no bullshit zone, if I may. So Doom, as usual, with my favorite chicken in the market, I would like to graciously say thank you so much for joining us, for adding so much to the Oil Ground Up podcast today, for bringing us so much, you know, organized intelligence that both traders and students of the market can get their head around. If you're going to go find Doomberg, sign up at doomberg.substack.com and read every single thing that he puts out like I do. And we will definitely have you back on the Oil Ground Up podcast soon to see, how we did on some of our calls today.
You're the best, Tom.
Absolutely. You're the best, Doomberg. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll get you back another time. And this is the Ground Up podcast signing off.
This episode of the Oil Ground Up with Tony Greer should not be perceived as investment advice. Tony, his guests here on the Oil Ground Up, and the host company Clear Commodity Network are not responsible for any losses arising from any investment decisions based on the information presented. Please do your own research and speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.